The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The matter at hand is the theme of the plan of salvation. We're looking at that under the heading of Christ and the decree. We saw under point A, in a preliminary way, how this idea is prepared for us in what the Scriptures teach about God as a person and how that comes to light in an unmistakable, though implicit way in the opening verses of Scripture. We were noting, however, that what may be obvious in terms of the coherence of biblical teaching, the system of doctrine, if you will, taught in Scripture, that's on the surface there, is widely denied, and we now want to take some time to at least probe the dimensions of that denial. We can say that particularly in the modern period, and by modern period I'm thinking of what we usually refer to, at least in Western culture, North European culture, as the Enlightenment, and the period beyond, now into our presumably postmodern era that we're supposed to have arrived. In this period, and in view of, as we're going to see, developments stemming from the Enlightenment or focused very self-consciously in the Enlightenment, the idea of God's all-encompassing plan begins to be called into a question. That there is this eternal plan of God that He has foreordained whatsoever comes to pass, to use the language of the Westminster Shorter Catechism, that is radically called into question more and more and eventually denied, roundly denied. Now, I don't want to suggest, by the way, that this teaching was not denied before, but we can particularly focus on the way in which this denial accelerates with the cultural, philosophical factors that come into play at the time of the Enlightenment. And we should just pause before to notice in a more general way, or accent in a more kind of overall way, before we try to delineate a little further how that's the case, this denial. You see, the notion of the divine decree is perceived, and you'll see correctly perceived in an Enlightenment tradition, that divine decree is perceived as a threat, an intolerable threat. It's seen as a violation of human freedom, as nothing less than the destruction of human integrity. But now, with this important qualification added immediately, the divine decree is seen as such a destructive threat to human freedom and integrity when these human freedom is defined in terms of human autonomy. And of course, that is the controlling factor that comes in. That's the controlling commitment of the Enlightenment. Man's autonomy, particularly rational autonomy. And that, I just simply want to underline that here and say just a further, we need always to keep in mind that the divine decree and human autonomy are irreconcilable. You can't have them both. Because human autonomy is an effort to put human freedom, in some respect, however little, however attenuated that might be, but the autonomy commitment is an effort to put human freedom outside of the determining decree, so that that effort those two are in tension with each other. Now, to delineate a bit further how things unfold here, and we'll basically follow a timeline from the 18th century to the present, but it's not a strict chronology either. These are viewpoints that often exist together in a given at a given time point. They and overlap, but it's basically a movement that we can present chronologically. The first position is that of deism. Deism. We can put the matter this way. Deistic are those constructions that hold that the creation owes its origin, but not its continuing or its continuation to God, or that the creation owes its continuation only indirectly to God. As indicated, this is the viewpoint that is more dominant in the early Enlightenment, 17th and 18th centuries. Sure. What marks a position as deistic is the stance that the creation, God is creator, that the creation owes its origin to God, but not its continuation, or only in an indirect way does it owe its ongoing preservation to God. Just to flesh that out a little bit further, what's held is that there is a fixed law order in the cosmos, and that fixed law order is there by virtue of creation, and that law order then certainly does establish a framework for what can or cannot take place. The law order, if you will, provides the parameters. But what in fact then transpires, what takes place in nature and history, that is not really under God's control or according to his plan. So that, you see, what happens here is that deism is a position that denies the radical dependence of the cosmos on God. The permanent dependence of the universe on God and his plan, as that is implied, that such radical dependence is implied in the notion of God's decree. So in terms of the perennial issue, the issue that is so important to have proper balance and understanding of the relationship between divine transcendence and immanence, we can say that what deism eclipses is the immanence of God, his radical and continuing involvement in the creation. Now, next we can go on and talk about developments as they become more and more dominant in the 19th century and continue down into this century. Pantheism, or really what is better described as panentheism. In view here are those constructions that see God and the cosmos as correlates, as eternally correlate. The one can't exist or even be thought of apart from the other. So there's a denial here of God's personal aseity, a denial of God's self-existence, his independence of the creation. On this view, or such constructions, and by the way, I should have mentioned, very influential here, is what philosopher particularly? Hegel. Dates of 1770 to 1831, particularly for introducing massive panentheistic modes of thinking in philosophizing, as that carries over then into theology. On this view, history, and particularly the unfolding of history then, is understood as a process by which God, and let's put God in quotes now, a process by which God increasingly comes to self-consciousness. History is that process, ultimately, of divine self-realization, as that divine self-realization takes place in human self-realization, in collective human consciousness. So that history on this approach is a virtually automatic process, or a process that is to be unfolds entirely from within and proceeds then on the basis of divine powers that are resident in the cosmos. So we can say that here, in view of our constructions, pantheistic, panentheistic, that deny the radical duality. And I choose that word, I'm not talking about some kind of dualism, but they deny the radical, what's denied here is the radical duality between God and the cosmos. The creator-creature distinction, in other words, as that is presupposed in the idea of God's decree. And while, by the way, my concern here is not so much to critique, analyze these viewpoints, but simply to identify them, we will leave interaction and effect to the next section when we look into the scriptures together. But we can observe here, with reference to this viewpoint, that God is not simply greater in the sense of being the higher component within the cosmos. God is the origin and the source of the universe and all that transpires in it, in the sense that everything is the realization of His conscious decree, the realization of His established purpose, His set goal. And it's that particularly that is called into question by these pantheistic tendencies. So we could say here that now it is divine transcendence that becomes eclipsed. Thirdly, we can mention, looking at developments accelerating in the latter part of the 19th century into and down to the present, views that we can dub, at least for our presentation here, as dimensionalism. Dimensionalism. And here we have in view efforts within the tradition of autonomy, of the autonomy commitment, within the what we could also call the historical critical tradition of biblical interpretation. This is an effort to overcome some of the tensions, some of the difficulties in the positions that we have already noted. And those difficulties that we can focus for our discussion here crystallize more and more as you move through the 19th century as the problem of history. What is perceived more and more on the autonomy commitment of being the difficulty of finding meaning in the undeniably historical nature of human existence. And of course, most pointedly for the Christian religion, trying to find meaning in view of the undeniably historical claims of the Christian religion. Here we can identify two streams that capture, again, what we've been talking about. On the one hand, rationalism, the viewpoint of the earlier Enlightenment, deism, deistic rationalism, finds that there is no ultimate truth in history. That meaning, truth, religious truth, can only be realized or asserted in terms of certain ideals that are above history. Such a rationalistic approach ends in that direction. Whereas what we often refer to then as historicism sees that the solution, particularly if claims are going to continue to be made for the uniqueness of the Christian religion, that truth is not beyond history, but the problem is that history relativizes, that ultimate or religious truth is swallowed up by the historical process. So now we have in view positions that are very much influenced by Immanuel Kant, again, who we talked about briefly last time. These are viewpoints particularly that operate with that fundamental disjunction, the discontinuity between noumenal and phenomenal. And let me just try to identify what's involved in this distinction again. This disjunction or distinction between noumenal and phenomenal results from a radically anthropocentric approach, so that reality is viewed and can be spoken of only as it is experienced by man. And what is maintained then is that on the assumption of human autonomy, reality is experienced by this, in terms of this disjunction, distinction, discontinuity. On the one hand, the noumenal is the realm, and realm language is really very misleading here because we're not really talking about a place out there, as it were, but this is always in terms of the experiencing human subject. So perhaps we speak better then as an aspect or dimension, which is why I've used this that term here. The noumenal is that dimension in terms of which human beings experience themselves to be free, know themselves to be free. This is the dimension then further of faith and encounter with God, religious certainty. The phenomenal, in distinction, is that dimension in terms of our experience, in terms or where the principle of causality reigns supreme. In terms of this dimension, we know ourselves to be bound, determined, subject to causal relationships. This is the dimension of necessity. So you see, we have a dialectic, if you will, or disjunction here between freedom and necessity. Freedom and necessity. But now further, so far as the phenomenal is concerned, this is the realm of pure contingency. The necessity is ultimately a contingent necessity. It's a matter of unlimited possibilities now, and that is to say ultimate uncertainty. In other words, earthquakes are going to happen, but you never know when an earthquake's going to hit. Further involved here is that events, facts, can only be explained in terms of immanent considerations. You can't go beyond the phenomena. You can't go beyond the phenomenal dimension for an explanation of the phenomena, historical and natural phenomena. So what's being said here is that, to be sure, this is the dimension of experience subject to causal relationships, but the laws, the patterns of causality emerge out of a matrix of ultimate contingency, irrationality, so that all historical occurrence is a matter of contingent necessity, accidental necessity. That sort of wraps it up here. Now, for such a dimensional approach, particularly so far as the phenomenal realm is concerned, and that is the realm, you see, of our historical experience. God and man, as God continues to be spoken about, God and man are seen as standing together over against an impersonal natural and historical process. A process that is absolutized. Remember, a process then that may express itself in an incalculable possibility of ways. So, to put it more colloquially, God and man are in the mess together, exposed to an autonomous phenomenal dimension. Or as some would want to present it and make it sound more biblical, God and man are covenant partners. They are in dialogue. As in this dialogue and in the freedom unique to them as God and man, they are together exposed to an autonomous phenomenal realm in a never-ending quest for meaning. That's the nature of human existence. And where the religious dimension is brought in, God and man involved together in always striving but never really arriving, an unending quest for meaning. Or to put it in other terms, it's a quest for certainty that ever exposes to ultimate uncertainty. Yes. Well, where it avenges itself today is, and we talked about this last time, is the fact-value distinction. But values are never, and we see increasingly in our day, what used to be morals became values, and now they're prejudices. All anyone has today is prejudices in a basically value-free continuum of experience. And you can see just from that you know, that has any number of applications. What I just wanted to add here further to fill this out, again, if we haven't gone too far afield, trying to do too much too quickly again, at least perhaps this comes out clearly, you can appreciate this. From this dimensional angle, virtually any and every possibility must be entertained, must be open to anything, except for one thing. And you guessed what that one thing is, that must be absolutely excluded. We don't bother to, we won't push here the fact that how you can, on this position, claim that something can be absolutely excluded. But what must not be allowed here is the notion of God's all-controlling plan and purpose. That is the one no-no, that history is the unfolding of the counsels of eternity. The drive here in its religious dimensions, again, is that anything must be done to preserve human autonomy, even if it means the price we have to pay is exposure to an ultimate uncertainty and irrationalism. And I just say, as we hear more and more these days about having been in now being in a so-called postmodern era, where the Enlightenment and strongly causal thinking has is supposed to be passé, I think we ought not to be confused here and led astray, even though I think we can value the critiques that are made of earlier forms of rationalistic thinking flowing from the Enlightenment. But I think in the midst of that, we need to be very clear that so-called postmodern thinking is even more hostile, I would want to argue, to the notion of an all-determining decree. It would see such a notion as a sort of rationalism that is even worse than anything that the Enlightenment produced. So people may be more open to the irrational. They may have a more open-ended view of the universe these days, relatively speaking, than was the case, say, even a generation ago. But it is not any more, I would want to argue, even less open to the notion of God's all-controlling decree. Yeah, go ahead. Well, I think that I guess it depends on what you mean by what denominations you're thinking of. I think that can you be more specific? What the PCUSA has today is a book of confessions, as it's referred to, in which virtually the Westminster Standards have become a museum piece, sort of a historical curiosity from which you can draw resources. But I'll be quite comfortable in saying that one place you won't draw resources from for today on this approach is Chapter 3 of the Westminster Confession, which has to do with God's eternal decree. See, basically, what the adoption of the Confession of 1967 and at the same time its inclusion in this book of confessions was really to relativize all confession and make it all questionable from the angle of the individual. The subscription vow is something to the effect these things so far insofar as they represent the gospel. Let's come just a bit closer to home to round off the denial, at least home for most of us, I suppose. And these comments would tie in especially with the reading that I'm asking you to do in Warfield's Plan of Salvation and also in Charles Hodge's Systematic Theology, the 10 pages there. In the tradition of historic Christian orthodoxy, there are those who can be said to hold the divine decree, but who do so, I think we are bound to say, at best only in a very inconsistent fashion, who hold to the divine decree in varying degrees, which is to say, hold it in varying degrees of inconsistency. And I won't go over the material you're reading there. Warfield, as he's writing, turn of the century, identifies the four main types: the Roman Catholic sacerdotal position, the Lutheran position, the Arminian position, earlier Remonstrant Arminian, the original followers of Arminius, and then the so-called evangelical or Wesleyan Arminian position. And I think Warfield's discussion is very helpful to delineate those. What is involved here when I speak of holding to the decree only inconsistently is that we find in these various positions the effort in salvation to exclude from the scope of the decree of God some factor, to exclude from the control of God, from His plan of salvation, some function resident in man. In other words, these are positions that anticipate and are, I think, in their tendency pointing to the kind of development, ultimately, that we have been sketching earlier here under these three main viewpoints. The concern is to maintain some form of human freedom, freedom in some sense, a little peace. And usually the focus here is on faith and the human capacity to believe. The concern that we cannot, that we must find some peace, some factor resident in man, some piece of freedom, aspect of freedom, outside of God's control. And here, if I mention particularly the work as it's developed most recently of Clark Pinnock, very much intent on this project. And I would say it's just at the point of what we're talking about here, the all-controlling decree of God, that we find coming to light what Dr. Van Til often spoke of in his writings as the isolation of the Reformed faith, the isolation of the Reformed position. Because I think it does need to be pointed out, even though we don't want to lose sight of affinities with non-Reformed evangelicals, I think it does have to be recognized that here the Reformed position stands alone in seeking to maintain the all-controlling decree. Well, with that sketch, what I'd like to do next, serving to interact with such viewpoints and also a more positive goal for ourselves, look at the biblical basis, and we'll dip into the biblical foundations here at several points. Again, this area is covered very excellently, in my judgment, in your readings, assigned readings, and I'm just taking the time here to reinforce a couple of points. You see, the first thing, I have the passages indicated there that we want to look at. First of all, in Acts chapter 2:23, and we can look together at 4:28. Wake up, it's Monday morning. Yeah. Let's just read briefly in the two contexts, and then we can comment. Now, Peter's Pentecost sermon, and in the midst of that, he confronts the men of Israel for what they've done to Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved by God among them with wonders and signs, miracles and signs and wonders, which God did through him in your midst, as you well know, or as you know. This one being handed over, understood to you, being delivered over to you by the determinate will and foreknowledge of God, you having crucified through the hands of wicked men, or lawless men, you have killed him, whom God raised up, loosing him from the pangs of death. And then over in chapter 4, reporting on to the other believers on their meeting with the Jewish leaders. At verse 5, you notice Peter and what is attributed to Peter and John, or what is the substance of what was said in this gathering. There's a reference to Psalm 2, the opening verses 1 and 2 of Psalm 2. And then this application, in effect, is made. The reference in the psalm to the kings of the earth opposing the Lord's anointed. For they were gathered together in truth in this city against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. And the they then is described further as Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel to do whatever your hand and your will predetermined to take place. Now, these are good verses to begin with because they focus on what is obviously, on any construction, central for salvation. The focus here is on what is decisive for our salvation, namely the death of Christ, the cross of Christ. Moreover, in the one instance, that happens in a context that is a high point in New Testament revelation, namely Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost. Now, a couple of things we want to note and underline here. We are told here, plainly and emphatically, this is Acts 2.23, what we need to focus on particularly, and this is 4.28. We're told quite specifically that the death of Christ takes place by the appointed will and foreknowledge of God. The New American Standard translates by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. The pre may be a little bit aggressive here in translation, but it certainly captures what's in view. NIV has by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. God's set purpose and foreknowledge. Similarly, in 4:28, the death of Christ, and not simply the death of Christ, but all of the events surrounding that death, are a matter of whatever your hand and will pre-purposed, literally, to happen. New American Standard, whatever thy God's hand and thy purpose predestined to occur. NIV, what your power, rendering the concrete hand abstractly, what your power and will decided beforehand to occur or should happen. Now, some questions come to mind immediately. What more exactly is the nature of this determination or predetermination that's in view? And further, relative to time, how are we to conceive of the time, if I could put it that way, or in relation to time, how are we to understand more precisely this predetermination, the pro that's involved in both statements? And I think in the light of the, particularly when these two statements are taken together, if nothing else, the orismene here, which doesn't, see this is from the orizo, and this is from pro orizo. In other words, we have a compound verb here with that prefix. Surely this is fairly interpreted by that. So the New American Standard, when it says pre-determined, is not off the mark in the sense involved. So there are those questions. We wanted to get at them. But notice what is unmistakable here. Whatever other questions we may have, Christ's death has its explanation. It has its ultimate explanation in God's deliberate will and plan. New English Bible, 1:2:23. The ultimate explanation is God's deliberate will and plan. Let me just comment a little bit further on that point. The cross of Christ, or more broadly, our salvation. You see, the cross, in its saving power, the cross is not ultimately a matter of reaction. Reaction. What I'm trying to get at here is that the cross is not some divine improvisation in response to the unforeseen contingency of human sin. The cross is not a heroic divine tactic to counteract the surprise of human sin, the unanticipated rebellion of man. We could say that to our minds, to our sinful minds, that sounds much more exciting, much better, more dramatic story, as it were. But again, the cross is not some kind of divine ad hoc maneuver. Rather, as comes through very clearly here, the cross is rooted in a plan that anticipates sin. And as we're going to see clearly all along, not only does it anticipate sin, it even utilizes sin for God's saving purposes. Now, it's worth noting further the indications we get here as to the comprehensiveness of God's purpose, the absolute sovereignty that is involved, the comprehensive sovereignty. You see, God's plan does not refer merely to the bare fact of Christ's death in some general or otherwise nonspecific way, but God's plan includes, brings into view, the actual specific means by which the death takes place. Again, means that left to our own insight, we might be inclined to exclude. What is it in these verses we are told is according to God's set purpose? Particularly looking at the chapter 4 passage. This is what God's set purpose embraces. You, that is, the men of Israel, excuse me, I'm looking at chapter 2 now. The men of Israel, verse 22, with the help of lawless men, have killed Jesus by crucifying him. Now, particularly there in just a comment here on the word, the adjective used as a noun in verse 23, anomon. Anomon, that's the genitive plural. And that means then literally what? You can see the reference to the law and then the negating alpha on it. So the thought here is of the lawless. So that when the NIV here translates wicked, or the New American Standard godless, those translations, while they may be defensible, I think they fail to bring out the sense clearly, a sense that we should be sure not to miss because it obscures something important. The reference here is to the lawless ones, that is, to the heathen, to the Gentiles, to those literally without the law. And this observation and the larger point that we're concerned to bring out here concerning the means involved, that is confirmed over now in the chapter 4 passage. Because what there happens, according to God's predetermination, is what is done by Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. So let's make sure, let me put these together now, let's make sure that we see this point here. What we're told is this, what is predestined to occur according to God's purpose, predestined according to purpose, is the conspiracy of both Jew and Gentile against the holy servant Jesus. As that conspiracy is focused in this alliance between Herod, the Jew, Pilate, the Gentile. This unholy alliance. But you see, what we're bound to go on and observe here, what we're being told here is that by God's design, all put Jesus to death. Not only the world, but the existing church, if you will, God's covenant people. Not only the world, but church and world conspire together. And this conspiracy carried out in the cross is the means to accomplish God's purpose. So in view here are what many have referred to as God's strange work, God's alien work. And that work in those dimensions is what we are going to keep exploring. But here we see something of it in all of its strangeness, comprehended by God's decree. And we then have a reminder here of what we always need to remember, and as Luther typically puts it in memorable language, the devil is God's devil. I don't just pick that statement up and run with it theologically, but it within proper context qualification, that is an important point. It's by His, God's, determinate counsel and foreknowledge that the Jews and Gentiles have crucified Jesus.